Welcome to Behavioral Grooves, the podcast that explores human behavior. I'm Kurt Nelson.
And I'm Tim Houlihan. We spend a lot of our time talking with researchers to unlock the mysteries of our behavior with a behavioral science lens. Now, this special episode is a follow-up to the most massive project that we've ever undertaken on this podcast, the five-part series on the history of behavioral economics called They Thought We Were Ridiculous.
And if you haven't checked it out, please do so. We partnered with Andy Luttrell at Opinion Science Podcast, and we love what was created. And guess what? It's free. No cost to you. Zilch. Zero denaros and all of that. Yeah.
Free? Free? Zero? Yeah. Got it. Okay.
Zilch. Nada. Whatever. Whatever other word. It's absolutely free for people.
It's also not some gummy history of a bunch of facts and figures. It's actually kind of a cool story that we think that everybody's going to enjoy.
Well, there's some facts and figures in it, but it's not gummy, that's for sure. And it was a massive project, and we're glad that we did it for several reasons. The most important reason is that no one has documented in podcast form the perspectives of the people who created an entirely new field of study. These days, we use the term behavioral economics without hesitation, but at one point in time, that was a crazy idea.
We also hear from some voices of people who were there at the beginning, you know, that have just not been documented anywhere else. You get to hear their story told in their words as well. So we just want you to urge you to check it out, all five episodes that arc their way through the earliest ideas, through some of the challenges that the founders met, to what the up-and-comers are thinking about behavioral economics now, like, what's the next generation of behavioral economists going to be up to? We cover all that.
Yes, yes. Please check it out. But in this episode, we're not going to go over the history of behavioral economics.
No.
This is Tim and my reflection on the experience of creating the series. We want to talk about what we learned from doing this project, and that is going to be this episode.
So you might ask, why would we share what we learned from doing this massive project with our listeners?
I don't know. Maybe because occasionally our listeners might get themselves into projects that are quite large and complex, where they have to collaborate with different people than normal while still needing to do all the other work that is typically on their plate. And maybe, Tim, just maybe, listening to this episode might make that next big project a tiny wee bit easier.
That's a compelling argument right there, Kurt. In the next episode, by the way, we're going to actually look at what we learned from this project. But in that episode, we'll review some of the big picture learnings about what made it possible to change an entire field. But that's not this episode. It's not a recap of the five-part series. Right now, all we want to do is focus on what it was like to do this project so that hopefully people will be able to take away some learning from that.
Yeah. So let's jump into this episode, Tim. What did we learn about doing a big project on a side hustle that might help our listeners find their groove?
So it might be a side project of a side project.
Side project of a side project. That's like the interesting piece of this for me, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like if I'm a solo artist, a solo musician, right? And I'm regularly writing and producing and recording and touring for my own thing. And then I join this band that I want to support, right? Because the band's really cool. And by the way, I'm not making any money from the band, but it's really fun to play with that band. And then somebody else says, well, could you produce, you know, my band in this one project? And it's like, well, wait a minute, I got my solo career and I've got my side hustle. And then in addition to that, I've got this other thing going. It's hard.
Hard. And this is what we found ourselves in, right? So Behavioral Grooves to start is a side hustle for us. We don't get paid. For listeners who are amazed by that, no, yeah, we actually support ourselves because we have full-time jobs or kind of, well, you know, Tim will talk a little bit about his situation right now, but this is a side project. And the making of They Thought We Were Ridiculous was a major side project of a side project.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that we didn't take this willy-nilly. We didn't go into this going, oh, we'll just, you know, spend a few hours and we'll have this fantastic history of behavioral economics. We knew that it was going to be big.
We did.
What I think was different, what we didn't anticipate, is that because it is a side project of a side project, that the priority stacking, this idea of what gets pushed to the bottom when other things pop up.
Yeah.
This was the project that happened. It took us 3 years. 3 years to bringing Andy in, to setting up the interviews with some Nobel laureates and other people who were at the beginning, and then researching what that background was and recording them. And then, oh, we got finally another person included. And then looking
That we hadn't anticipated at first. And right. It's like, oh, now we have to rework the story because we got this new perspective.
And then putting the arc together and saying, oh, does this the way it flows? And how many episodes is this? Is it was 3? Is it 4? Is it 5? Is it 10? You know, what are all of those factors? And it, every point, it was something that we had not as our main moneymaker, mm-hmm. not even as this thing that we put out every single week, but as a special project to that side project. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, in this priority stacking thing, I don't remember ever thinking, what am I going to give up to get this done?
We didn't.
Never did it cross my mind to say, this is going to take a certain amount of time. And of course, I'll just make time for it. Well, making time means, to do this means reducing time on something else. And I don't know why that was so difficult to imagine.
Yeah.
But I never thought about, okay, what, less Netflix, less playing guitar, less exercise, less eating, less conversation. And what am I going to give up? Something has to give, right? Less sleep.
Right. Well, and part of this, so Behavior Grooves, for the past 6 years, we've been doing mostly on Friday mornings, right? It is our routine. We gather together. We have a morning meeting on Fridays. We typically do our interviews with we'll build out our grooving sessions. We are all of that. So we could have said, well, instead of having 4 Behavioral Grooves episodes every month or one every week, one Friday a week, we just spend on, They Thought We Were Ridiculous. But we didn't do that. We didn't give that up.
No.
Right? We continued on with that. And those are things, again, in retrospect, you kind of go, wow, that was something maybe we should have taken into consideration. I think the other thing, Tim, and we talked about this going into it.
Yes.
This is the crazy piece. Yep. Did we have any planning fallacy on this?
huge. We completely underestimated the scope of the project in terms of the actual hours. And then while we're actually doing the project, planning fallacy becomes part of the scripting in one of the episodes. And it's still, we're suffering from the planning fallacy.
We talked about it when we started. We talked, we're going to take, 3 to 6 months to get this done. And the 6 was the long stretch because we knew 3 was probably planning fallacy, right? Multiply that by however many 3+ years that it took. So this goes back to one of my favorite Danny Kahneman quotes, and I'm going to misquote him here, but this idea, like when he was asked, oh, well, you're an expert in these biases, so obviously you aren't impacted by them as much. And he's like, oh, no, I am. This is, I'm human right. just like everybody else. Right. Knowing about the planning fallacy wasn't enough for us to overcome it.
It would have been so much better if when we were initially starting the project to say, okay, how much time is it going to take to record 18 interviews? How much time is it going to take to review the transcriptions? How much time is it going to take to research the papers that the guests start to discuss or read their books? How much time is it going to take to write the scripts, to record the scripts? You know, we could have gone through all these steps in much more minutia, and we would have been better off than just thinking about, oh, let's set a deadline of 6 months from now.
Yeah. Well, and then back, kind of putting that back into our schedules, going back to this idea that we did not remove anything. So, okay, we have, and I will also let people know, you know, at the beginning, we didn't know how many interviews we were going to do. And so there was probably a little bit of that where, oh, are we going to do 10 interviews? Are we going to do 20 interviews? Are we going to do 40 interviews? You know, we put out a lot of requests and a lot of people accepted, and you know, some didn't, but
some,
but even with that, so all right, 18 interviews, hour each, planning and structuring for those, another hour to 2 hours in front of that at least. So, you know, for every interview, let's just mildly estimate 4 hours. All right, 18 times four, right there. I do my math right, right? We're talking 60 plus hours on that, something along that line.
And which you do in your business work, right? When you're doing consulting, Kurt, I know that you do this because we have done projects together where we have these conversations regularly. And yet it was a huge miss that we didn't do that when we were planning for this project.
Right. So I think it's a big insight. And again, because it was a side project of a side project, I think that had to weigh in. It wasn't a consulting project. I wasn't billing for this. I didn't have to figure out how many hours it was going to take me to put a price down for a client to say, hey, this is going to take us 150 hours to do, therefore we have to charge you X. Didn't have to think about it that way.
Yeah. And because you didn't have to, we didn't.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Like another key component for me was collaboration, the idea of working not just with the two of us, but with Andy. And I think that I underestimated, maybe we collectively underestimated the challenges and the rewards that come from this kind of collaboration.
Yeah. And I think part of that was we collaborate well together. We've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, you put up with me,
and vice versa.
Well, I think we complement each other, right? And I think there's, you know, I'm not going to say we're the Amos and Danny, but you know, we're the Amos and Danny of the podcasting world. oh my God, that sounded very arrogant. We collaborate really easy. We have our, and because we've been doing it so long, we have our own routines. We have our own language. We understand each other's voice. We understand a whole bunch of different things. And so I think we were naive because we thought, oh, we can bring somebody else in, and it'll be just as smooth as what we do together. And we're not saying that this was it worked. It worked really well. But it wasn't always, you know, as easy as we probably thought it would be.
In part because the rhythms that we gather and the habits that we have developed in you and I working together weren't automatically and systematically part of working with Andy. He is a fantastic writer and editor and producer, and Opinion Science is a fantastic product that he has his own rhythms about. We failed collectively, all three of us sort of failed to take into consideration, well, what are the rhythms that we're going to bring together in this? Because the habits and work routines are going to make a difference. I remember we did have a conversation about it at the front end, but we addressed it rather naively and in kind of a shallow manner.
Right. And I think there's an inherent challenge with the production of something so large with three people.
Yeah.
And we had you know, for us, we had two different producers during that time. We had Mary and Caroline as we're working on this in the background, plus a bunch of my team that was working on some of the creative stuff in various different pieces. So we had lots of viewpoints and opinions, and bringing all of those together without having, you know, this was, you know, the decisions we had to make. There wasn't one person who had final authority to say, this is how we're going to do it.
Right.
Right. We all had veto power. That is hard because, again, we'd like to think that it's a meritocracy, that the best ideas, that the best copy, the best way of putting this together would float up. But it's hard when maybe those best ideas aren't mine. Right.
Right.
And that's what ultimately ended up. I mean, most of the best ideas weren't mine. Right. I mean, I don't know if there was any best ideas that were mine, but it, regardless of that, right, this idea of being able to take our egos and just, okay, our egos have to be kind of curbed a little bit. This idea that we're going to go in and do this the same way that we do our normal stuff had to be altered. We had to rethink how we worked, not just as a triumphant, but even how you and I work together on this, right?
Yeah, that it changed.
It was different in working in this project versus how we work generally in this.
In recognition of Lori Santos's G.I. Joe fallacy, this idea that knowing isn't even half the battle, is not even close to being half the battle. I think that we could have done a better job of anticipating these kinds of things if we had taken time up front to do a better job of planning. Because you do, again, this isn't foreign to either of us. We've worked on big projects with lots of people. And when we have, it's been in a very scripted work environment where we're thinking about billing hours, or we're thinking about the hours that other teammates are going to be providing and delivering, and how much time do we want of everybody, and what expertise do we need from them. So I want to urge our listeners to think about, if you're going to do a side project like this, take the time to go through the planning up front so that you really have an understanding, like you would in your work, in your day job, to what the investment might be like.
And it's interesting because I think the other piece is in those upfront conversations. Talk about things like, we had different ideas on what we needed to maximize and what we could satisfy, I think. I think there are different viewpoints on some of those elements. Whereas I'm like, on, we're perfectly fine in, you know, having a more open, scripted or unscripted type of conversation that was antithetical to, you know, you and Andy to a certain degree in these interviews.
Right.
Because there was a story arc that needed to be followed and or that we were aiming for. And so, again, there's this.
Different priorities. Yeah.
Different priorities. And we weren't clear up front about how that would occur. And are we okay with those? And yeah, it worked itself out, but I think we could have worked it out earlier and probably had less of an emotional roller coaster on this, which I think is our next topic here, is that this was an emotional roller coaster, not just from the dynamics of working together in a group, but just of a big project in general. I think there was the idea that we're going to get this done in 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, and then all of a sudden it's not, and we're not making any progress on things, and that felt, you know, down to, my God, we got it. You know, Daniel Kahneman said yes to doing an interview with us, and Richard Thaler did as well. Oh my God. And now we're actually getting George Lowenstein to be on, you know, to record.
Podcast. Yeah.
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 So,
yeah. So I think an important point that you just made is that the emotional roller coaster wasn't just challenges, difficulties, gut turmoil. There was a lot of rewards as well. There were ups and, you know, there was downs, but there were lots of ups as well. Like, oh man, like the way that recording just came out was really cool. And it reminds me of experiences with playing with a band. Like, man, you can create really cool music with other people in ways when everybody just finds the groove at the right time and things just sync up and everything plays just perfectly. And you just go, that happened so spontaneously and so beautifully and so wonderfully that I couldn't have anticipated it. And I just relish that.
Yeah.
And we had those moments. We had those experiences in this project. And that wouldn't have happened if it was just you or just me or even just the two of us.
Right.
It happened because we had, Mary and Caroline and Ben and Alex and Alexa, you know, contributing and going, oh my God, like that piece of artwork, like that is so cool. Like yeah. That logo is so cool. I couldn't have come up with that myself.
Yeah. Well, and to that degree, right? I mean, this idea of there's a sense of frustration, this lack of control that I'm not the one, you know, writing this script. And so then, but then there's this elation of when you get the script, it's like, holy crap, that I wouldn't have gone there, but man, that is a really good way of bringing the story to life. And, you know, yeah, there's the frustration of, how many different deadlines did we have? I mean, even up till the end, we were going to release it at the beginning of January. And then, you know,
we weren't ready.
It got pushed back to February. And so even at the end, I mean, there's probably been 5-6 different deadlines that we've had that we've blown right. through every single one of them.
Yeah.
But now we're there. And yeah. It's like, great. So, yeah.
And kind of all for good reasons, by the way. You know, I remember Andy saying, by the way, I had a child.
You know, well, there's some other things in there. You know,
so. Yeah, you know, there's real life. So, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I think we've talked a lot about kind of our experience of working with this. It was side project of a side project. It was, we didn't take, you know, time to really do a good deep dive to understand exactly how much time it would take. We didn't necessarily think about what this new collaboration and mixing rhythms and personalities and styles of work together and the positives and negatives of that. We didn't think about, you know, some of the emotions that we would go up and down and how that would all plan itself out. But if we had to do this again, what are some of the things that we would do differently, and maybe that people, our listeners, can take away when they're thinking about or doing a project like this?
The first thing that comes to mind is to do a Annie Duke pre-mortem. Mm-hmm. To start with, and this isn't just at a very high and strategic level, it's at a very specific level. I think this would have assuaged the planning fallacy if we would have said, okay, how many interviews? How long is each interview going to take? How much prep? How much time needs to be set aside for prepping for that interview? How much time needs to be set aside after the interview for sort of consolidating our notes and deciding what's usable and what's not? It just to get to that level of specificity would have been extremely helpful. If we would have approached this project up front, not just for the planning purposes of it, but just it's an expectation level set that we all could have benefited from.
Yeah.
How about you?
No, I agree with that. You know, this idea of doing a pre-mortem is really important in helping that planning fallacy. So you talked about it earlier. It's like, think about this. Here's one piece is because this was a side project of a side project, I keep going back to that. We could have looked at this, and I think in retrospect, we should have. And when we're doing next series, we need to think about them more as business projects. That this is, what do we need to give up? What are we going to forsake, or how are we going to get this done? Mm-hmm. What are the number of hours that we have to do in order to make this happen? what are the steps and who's going to own what and what are the what how are we going to hold people accountable? I think there's all of that preloaded elements up front. And I think that is a big insight, is we should have slowed down at the beginning to speed up throughout the process.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. We could have used more of an agile, you know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with agile, and a big difference in the way agile looks at projects is rather than thinking about, okay, we've got 100% of all this stuff to get done to call it complete. How do we get to the first 10% and yes. then the next 10%? Agile says, okay, so we've got 100% to get done, but let's look at the first 10% and say, how can we get 100% of our first 10% done? Like, let's look at the first 10% as a project. And then the second 10%, let's look at that as a project. We could have been more discreet. We could have, I think it would have been really good to have, you talked about accountability, like a project manager to keep track of things and say, this is what is done. This is what is done and this is what is not done. And we said we were going to do these things in this amount of time. And as a side project to a side project, we didn't want to be held accountable at that level. We just didn't.
And neither, well, I'm not a good project manager. I know that about myself. I know that, which is why when we do this stuff for work, right, it is there. So I think that is really key. As we're moving forward, and I think back on this, I think a lot of what we did was fantastic. The end product I am super, super, super proud of. Mm-hmm. And so some of the back and forth that we had that in the moment felt maybe a little frustrating or tumultuous or however, you know, the emotional side of it, understanding that that's some of the price that you have to pay sometimes mm-hmm. yep. for creating something that you can be really proud of. And being the Midwestern nice guy that I am and, you know, conflict averse, I don't like those. And yet I have to understand that maybe I need to become more comfortable yeah. with having those types of conversations, pushing back and having some of that, which I don't think I, you know, was as comfortable nor still am. I need to lean into that.
So I want to ask you one last question here before we sign off, but I'll give you time to think about it while I answer, because this is something that I thought about that we didn't prep for. But that is, what are you grateful for in this project? And I want to say first and foremost, I'm grateful to you for entertaining my crazy idea that came from a conversation with George about how they came up with the name of behavioral economics.
Yeah, it was all about the name. It's like, we did it. Yeah.
And you were like, well, maybe there's a series there. Maybe there's something more than just, you know, one little idea. And so I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to Andy for joining on this and being willing to say yes. We didn't know each other well. We had been guests on each other's podcasts, but he really brought a lot to the overall framework and design, and of course the scripting, and he carried the burden on the editing and production in a really great way. I'm really grateful for him on that. And I'm really grateful that we get to do this. I'm really grateful that we have listeners who will benefit from this, that we have someone to share this story with, right? That it's not just you and me having lunch going, wasn't it great that you and I got to talk about the history of behavioral economics with Andy for, you know, a whole bunch of hours. Like, we get to share this with people, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I am eternally grateful to Andy. We reached out to Andy because we had heard a couple of his episodes that he had done looking at the history of cognitive dissonance and some of that. And we just loved the storytelling piece. And so I am super grateful because I learned so much in working with him about how to craft that arc, to create that story, to bring a voice, to have a vision for what the sound and story is going to be. And that I think we will take forward, and hopefully it'll be integrated into the work that we bring, you know, in this podcast, our own. And so super grateful for Andy and all of the beyond all of the great work that he just did. I'm grateful for you because as anybody who knows me, I am great. And I'm saying this as a humble brag, maybe, and maybe I shouldn't, but you know, I pride myself on ideas, and I'm much worse on implementation, which is part of the issue of why I think this took 3+ years, right? Is this idea of great, I got these great ideas and this, you know, concepts and various different pieces, but you know, bring it. And you and Andy did the bulk of all of the heavy lifting. And this wouldn't have been done without you and Andy doing that work. And I am so eternally, eternally grateful for that. And different pieces. I'm grateful for my team jumping in and working on this when this is a side project that I forced them to be on, right? This isn't a side project that they chose. This is a side project that I said, oh yeah, you guys are working on this. And they did a fantastic job. And
they had to solve all kinds of problems that we never anticipated they'd have to solve for.
Oh yeah.
And Ben and Alex especially just like really jumped out of their norm and just figured things out. That was just really cool.
And I'm really grateful for our guests and for sharing their stories, for sharing their memories of this, even when those memories disagreed with each other. And we still don't really know the truth. But the willingness and to have Nobel laureates, to have world-renowned researchers, to have these people who live very, very busy lives, and getting requests across the board, I'm sure, to spend an hour or more with us, with, you know, us just talking, I thought was just very gracious of their time. And I am just very thankful for that.
Yeah, agreed on all that.
Actually, I have one question. So right now, we talked about this being a side project of a side project. Mm-hmm. If we were to do this again today, how would that be for you?
Well, it would be different because I don't have a main gig
as of
the recording of this this episode. My gig at the bank ended in a massive $750 million payroll reduction strategy. So, yeah.
So any of our listeners out there who have need of a brilliant mind and a emotionally intelligent person who can work, you know, wonders with getting people in a room to connect and to understand behavioral science. I mean, you know, this is your opportunity, because this won't last long. This will be gone. I'm already trying to get you some gigs. I got some stuff lined up, and I know you have some other things on the road. But for anybody that's out there, reach out to us if you have any need of a brilliant behavioral scientist and person who can come in and help you with that. So.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. I appreciate the promo. And yeah, as I say, DM me or hit me up or whatever. Send me an email. Call me. Maybe more importantly, stay tuned for the next episode as Kurt and I are going to discuss the learnings, what it's like to talk to Nobel laureates and brilliant researchers in the field of behavioral science. It's going to be another short grooving session, or maybe not so short, who knows. And it's going to act as sort of a way to wrap up some of the lessons that we learned in starting, what's it like to actually start big movements with big ideas.
Yes, we'll be bringing that to you soon. So we hope you join us.